You're tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and we also stream on the web at kzyx.org. It's 6:58 p.m. here in the Mendocino studios on a beautiful spring evening, and we welcome you. We're getting ready for education now, so stay tuned, and here we'll go with a little bit of music. But before the music, I want to let you know that Education Now is brought to you tonight. Support for Education Now comes from our members and the producers of Education Now, the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. All programs aired on Education Now are available online for listening with download at our website www.pacificsites.com/Hermes. And my personal contact is hermes@pacific.net. And we welcome you tonight here on KZYX and Z. And I'm looking forward to this show tonight. So let's get on with our music. And here, since we didn't have the California report, everything's just a little bit different than normal. So here we go.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why.
Well, here we are in the KZYX and Z studios, and welcome to Education Now. Before we begin tonight's show, I wanted to talk about some questions from last month. People had called in and asked, is there a pay difference between administrators' pay and teachers' pay? And I said, I'll find out. And I found out it's 2 to 3 times more for an administrator than it is for a teacher. Regarding other matters, a person called in and said, gee, music and arts are being cut out of Ukiah High School. Everybody's getting pink slips. Will those people be reinstated when the stimulus package starts? Well, I don't have any news on that, but as soon as I do find out, I will let you all know. But talking about pink slips and the contrast between public schools getting pink slips and charter schools getting pink slips, the thing is that when charter schools started here in the state of California, people were told that they could not, if they had a charter school, they had to keep 15% that they received in abatement. You know, they had to keep it so that they could, you know, in case they failed, well, they could rescue themselves. So now when public schools, regular ones, are getting pink slips, the charter schools are not having the same problem because they have that savings. I don't know if you call that karma or not. There are some big Pell Grants coming through, huge amounts of money to stimulate the desire for people to return to college or to go to college, that President Obama has for everyone to do that. And so there's huge amounts of money coming in terms of Pell Grants. I don't know how successful that will be, but I do hope that it works. Now, some news from eduvoice.org, that's eduvoice.org. While it's essential that we have high expectations for all students to achieve, it's also important to recognize improvements each year. Not all kids start off the school year at the same level academically. Nevertheless, California's current accountability system sets the expectation that schools get all kids to the target of grade level proficiency by the end of each school year. This approach does not account for the fact that beginning levels of achievement can vary each school year among each group of new students entering a given grade. As a result, schools and school districts, particularly with middle grades and at high school level, are often unfairly held accountable for the low performance of the school the students previously attended. AB 1130 supports efforts to add a measure of the current year growth in student achievement to the API. Measuring growth will acknowledge the hard work of educators and students across California and facilitate a culture of ongoing improvement. And when we know which programs have the greatest impact on improving student achievement and closing achievement gaps, we will be better able to focus limited resources to serve our kids. This bill is scheduled to be heard soon in the Assembly Education Committee, and that's on edvoice.org if you're interested in that. From the Alliance for Childhood, Crisis in the Kindergarten, April 2009. Our major new report, Crisis in the Kindergarten, Why Children Need to Play in School, is now posted on our website. It summarizes the findings of three Alliance-sponsored studies of what is happening to open-ended play in public kindergartens and puts them in the larger context of what we know about young children's real needs. The findings are alarming. Kindergarten playtime is increasingly rare. Most of the teachers surveyed said they are spending 2 to 3 hours per day teaching and testing children in literacy and math skills. Standardized testing and test prep practices that most child development experts reject as inappropriate and harmful are daily activities in most of the classrooms studied. Teachers in Los Angeles mainly use curricula that require them to follow scripts for hours each day, despite research showing poor long-term results for this approach. In general, didactic early education is much less effective than play-based methods are, yet the academic drills and tests are winning out. At the same time, kindergarten retention and serious behavioral problems are on the rise. Crisis in the Kindergarten argues that current methods are putting children's long-term health and school success at risk. We call for a new focus on child-initiated play and experiential learning in early education, avoiding the extremes of the chaotic laissez-faire classroom on the one hand and didactic joyless instruction on the other. Our work is provoking passionate responses. David Elkind, whom you listeners have heard on this show, called the research findings heartbreaking. Deborah Meyer called the report a careful account of what's actually happening in early childhood classrooms and added, "The news is frightening." Crisis in the Kindergarten is online at www.allianceforchildhood.org, along with an 8-page summary, a 1-page flyer, and press releases. And then, here's some fun news. Kids come sign up for our free book program. TV turn off, get on board the Imagination Library. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. That's right, come get the little engine that could. Your first free book of many with parents when parents enroll their children for the Imagination Library. Join First Five Mendocino and celebrate TV Turn Off Week with the launch of this wonderful free book program, April 20th through 26, 2009. We invite all 0 to 5-year-olds to participate in our community events and get on board the Imagination Library. There's something Sunday, April 18th from 9 to 4, the Spirit Walk Run in Redwood Valley Rancheria. Tuesday, April 21st, 10:30 to 1 p.m., Imagination Library Kickoff Celebration at the Ukiah Library. Thursday, April 23rd, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m., Storytime and Craft at the Willits Library. Friday, April 24th, 6 to 7 p.m., Storytime and Puppet Show, Waldorf Elementary, Calpella. Saturday, April 25th, 10 to 5 p.m., Home Expo Show at Mendocino College. Sunday, April 26th, 10 to 4 p.m., Home Expo Show, Mendocino College. Call First Five Mendocino at GoChild 462-4453 for more TV turn-off materials and information. And then lastly, Confronting Anti-Semitism, a family awareness project of the Anti-Defamation League. Workshop in Ukiah sponsored by Kol HaAmic Jewish Community. Please save this date Sunday, April 26, 2009, 1 p.m. to 4 at the Kol HaAmic, 8591 West Road, Redwood Valley, next to Eagle Peak School. Confronting Anti-Semitism workshops are designed for parents and kids from grades 6 to 12, led by trained facilitators from the Anti-Defamation League, interactive and adapted to our community's needs. For more information, contact Yvonne Corin at ycoren@att.net. That's ycoren@att.net. Well, that's all my news for this evening, and so now let's get on with tonight's show. Well, tonight, my guests right here in the studio on Education Now are Emiliano Ayala, PhD, Associate Professor with the Department of Educational Leadership and Special Education at Sonoma State University. Dr. Ayala teaches and writes about the impact of cultural diversity in education, collaboration and legal issues in special education, and universal design for learning in higher education. In addition to his teaching responsibilities, Dr. Ayala's professional interests include post-secondary students with disabilities. Currently, Dr. Ayala serves as Project Director for ENACT, a U.S. Department of Education program, and co-director for Access by Design, a National Science Foundation program. These two federal grants are designed to support professional development activities for faculty and administrators at institutions of higher education with the goal of providing a quality post-secondary education for students with disabilities. In his role for ENACT and Access by Design, Dr. Ayala presents a variety of workshops which focus on the implementation of universal design for learning in higher education. These workshops have been offered across multiple California state universities, the California State University campuses, and have stimulated wide interest among California State University faculty in improving the teaching and learning processes for all students, including students with disabilities. As well, Dr. Ayala has instituted faculty learning communities as an instrumental component to support faculty in making UDL changes to their courses. To date, more than 250 faculty and staff have received professional development support from Dr. Ayala's efforts to implement ENACT and Access by Design. More importantly, participants note that these activities have been some of the most rewarding professional development opportunities in their careers. Dr. Ayala received his BA in psychology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Well, I want to tell you that's very impressive to me because UC Santa Cruz and Sonoma State University, after the 80s and Prop 13, were two of the only California systems that still offered the humanities. And by that I mean the true humanities, not behaviorism. And so that's very impressive to me, and that was 1986, and an MA in counseling psychology from San Diego State University in 1989, which is also very impressive. He received his PhD in education in 2000 from the San Diego State University Claremont Graduate University Joint Doctoral Program. Well, Claremont is very dear to my heart because they introduced Montessori to California, and they also introduced Jung. So he joined the faculty at Sonoma State University in 2000. Welcome, Dr. Ayala, to our studios.
Thank you, Athena. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And also with us tonight is Sarah Rachel Esserman, BA in Liberal Studies. And we're going to let Sarah introduce herself from this recording from the 2008 graduation ceremonies for people getting their credentials in special education at Sonoma State last spring. And Sarah was asked to be a speaker for that program, and so we're going to hear that right now.
Good evening. It's been 14 years since I last stood on this stage and looked out over the audience. Back then, I was a Hutchins major, working on a minor in dance. It's so surreal to be here again. I keep waiting for Dr. Mandavi to call me and say, I'm just joking. It's not really you that's going to do the speech. Or email me and write, oh, I'm sorry, I emailed the wrong person. But I guess it's me since I'm standing here tonight and it's too late for them to change their minds now. It's strange for me to think that the Special Education Department at Sonoma State feels that I'm intelligent enough to write a speech and then actually give it. I can't help but remember the little girl who was called into the office in third grade. There, my parents were being told that I couldn't read. I knew I couldn't read. What was the big deal? They wanted me to repeat third grade. I pleaded with my parents and promised to go to tutoring over the summer. This was the first wall in my academic career that I met face first as I was running full force through childhood. As I grew older, I kept running into these proverbial walls. I had to take the high school exit exam 6 times before I passed. Sonoma State admitted me as a freshman on the condition that I retake the SATs. I guess it was a good thing because it proved beneficial. I did do better by 1 point. I decided to go overseas for my junior year in college. I put all of my things in storage, paid all of the fees, and had my plane ticket in my hand when 2 weeks before I was to set off for Israel, I received a letter from Hebrew University in Jerusalem stating that since my SAT scores were so low, they were rescinding my acceptance. It was yet another wall. These walls also include people, like the college professor that told me if I would just study, I would do better in her class. Or the third grade teacher that had the entire class turn around and look at me because I was hiding under my desk that was separated away from the rest of the class. Or being the only student not to graduate out of the low reading group that met at the back of the classroom with the elderly couple that came in to volunteer their time. So with all these walls hitting me in the face, I guess you're wondering how I got here tonight. How I graduated high school, completed my junior year in Israel, graduated college, and am now finishing my second teaching credential. It is partially due to the teacher who discovered my learning disability, but also due to the teachers that helped me find my gifts. The teachers that taught me how to navigate up those walls and to learn from them. The teachers that held my hand and taught me self-empowerment and to advocate for myself. I learned more from the teacher that smiled at me, the one that encouraged me to read, and the teacher that launched my writing, than from the ones that could not see me beyond my disability. But there is another teacher who is very dear to me. This is the teacher that has always been with me. It is the teacher in me. I'm an intrinsic learner. I want to learn and will teach myself. We need to find the teacher in each of our students. We need to cultivate that teacher, the intrinsic learner within everyone. Help our students teach themselves what it is to be a learner. Help them to find their love for learning and discover their process to scale every wall that confronts them. My process is different than other people, and I got here in my very own way, just as I am here for my own reasons. I am here today because I have always had a drive to prove that I could do anything I wanted. I have proven the teachers wrong that said I would never graduate high school. If only they could see me now. We all have our reasons for being here. I know it is not job security and it's not money. Yet, here we all are. We are here because we believe in children. We know that we need to find that drive in each of our students and cultivate it. We know this because we have done it in ourselves. Many of us are teachers and parents and students all at the same time, trying to balance our responsibilities. Mm-hmm. We have a deep-rooted drive to succeed and to bring our students along with us. When we leave here tonight, we will use our people first language and remember the walls which we each had to scale to get here. We will step through those doors and into our classrooms, where we will run straight into more walls built out of standards, regulations, and laws. Together we will hurdle over them, guiding our students on the path to self-empowerment, knowledge, and life skills. Since I was 7 years old, I wanted to be a teacher so that I could help students like myself. At times, that didn't seem possible. But when doubt was foremost in my mind, a great teacher would throw me a rope and help me ascend. So I leave you with this challenge: to supply your students with the tools and skills needed to scale the walls they will face during their academic careers and their lives. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Athena.
Well, now, thank you both for being here tonight. So, Dr. Ayala, I have been waiting for 2 years to do this show, and I just can't thank you enough for driving here and being here tonight. And I wanted to start with the first question to you in two parts. Could you tell us what the history of special education is, and could you answer the question, isn't disability just another facet of diversity?
Sure, I'd be happy to answer those questions. Again, thank you for allowing me to be here and talk a little bit about this. The history of special education, Athena, do we have 2 hours? Do we have a week to talk about it? You know, as I thought and reflected on that question, I think the proper context to set is understanding that the history of special education really is as a result of the Civil Rights Movement from the 1950s, and there was a lot happening in our nation at that time in terms of other, quote, disenfranchised groups. And you think about the work from Brown versus the Board of Education and the instrumental things that happened there to really break down educational walls for other groups. So when we think about the history of special education, we have to set it in that context that it really began in many ways as a civil rights movement. And again, another way to think about the history of special education is sort of breaking it up into three very distinct eras or phases that we have gone through. So we talk about the first segment of special education, really a time frame really before the 1970s. And we titled that, or we labeled that, the era of exclusion. And why the era of exclusion? Well, really, before the 1970s, we had no major piece of federal legislation that protected or guaranteed the rights for individuals with disabilities to have access to a public education. This is, Athena, the 1970s. This is not that long ago. That's not to say that there weren't groups or individuals or advocacy organizations that were trying to help individuals with disabilities in a variety of capacities. And again, that was occurring before the 1970s. Certainly the formation of United Cerebral Palsy and the Muscular Dystrophy Association. But again, those were sort of individual attempts or advocacy attempts for groups to come together to help support individuals with disabilities. But really before the 1970s, many individuals with disabilities were either institutionalized or simply told not to come to school. Yeah. I always refer in one of my classes to the example of the film Forrest Gump and what mom had to do in order for him to be able to attend public school. Again, there were specific laws enacted across various states before the 1970s that prohibited individuals with disabilities from attending school. So again, very clearly there was an era of exclusion. But as a result of the civil rights movement of the 1950s, again, these advocacy groups in the field of special education began to say, hey, wait a minute, us too, right? Don't we have certain inalienable rights as well? And so right in the 1970s or so began the second era, and we call that the era of segregation. And it really began with a pretty significant piece of federal legislation. At that point, it was called the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, signed in 1975 by then President Gerald Gerald Ford. And again, this was the first piece of federal legislation that guaranteed the rights for individuals with disabilities to have a free and appropriate public education. So again, it wasn't until the mid-1970s that we could ensure or guarantee that individuals with disabilities in the public schools would not be discriminated for that. So what happened, Athena, at that time? What happened was, really fascinating when we take a look at the history, was we created a separate system of education in the field of special education. And Athena, for the most part, no one cared that we were creating these two separate pathways. Now, it wasn't intentionally a separate pathway. But again, when this piece of federal legislation was enacted, Congress did say we're going to give money to states in order to create the system of special education. So what happened? Well, they started building separate schools. You'd have Lincoln and Lincoln East, or you'd have Steel Lane and Steel Lane Annex. So again, they were often co-located or placed on public school campuses, but they really were a separate, segregated system of education where students with disabilities were being educated. Again, for the most part, people didn't complain because where did we come from? We came from nothing. And so the fact that we finally had a space of our own and we could begin hiring teachers and we could begin using some basic resources in order to work with individuals with disabilities, no one really minded that we were creating this sort of separate, segregated setting for individuals with disabilities. A couple of the key principles in that piece of federal legislation were the concept of a free and appropriate public education. Certainly, we were not going to charge individuals with disabilities in order to have or have access to an education, but it also had to be appropriate. And that's one of the other pieces that we struggle with, is how do we do it appropriately? Another critical concept in that piece of federal legislation was what we call LRE, or least restrictive environment. And the intent behind that piece of or component of the legislation was this idea that to the maximum extent appropriate, we would try to educate students with disabilities with typically developing peers or individuals without disabilities. But it was to the maximum extent appropriate, which meant that it allowed for some children who it was deemed would not be appropriate to be pulled out of or taught in separate segregated classroom settings. And again, we have to remember that this piece of federal legislation, IDEA as we call it now, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, really allowed for that individualization of a child's education, a child with a disability. But again, it always allowed for that opportunity that somebody could make a decision somewhere that the child shouldn't be in a regular classroom, but rather appropriately for him or her be educated in potentially a separate segregated setting. So what happened during that era of segregation is we really began to think more critically as a field of special education about this idea of what is the end goal, right? What is the point of what we're trying to do? And if ultimately we want individuals with disabilities to be included in society, if schools mirror our society, should we not be making a greater effort to have students with disabilities educated with everyone else? That's when we began the third era, or what we call the era of inclusion or integration. And that's sort of where we're at now in the 1990s and till to some extent today.
Hallelujah.
Yes, absolutely. But again, there's some interesting challenges related to that, because whereas we began to recognize that if we did want to have individuals with disabilities be integrated or accepted in society, that had to begin in schools. Yeah. And yet, as a result of how we wrote this piece of legislation that allowed for this idea of the least restrictive environment and individual decisions about what is right for an individual student, the fact that we had a separate place for them somewhere along the way, people were making decisions that this was not right, that a child with a disability could be educated with their peers. And so we still, to this day, continue to have these sort of separate, segregated settings under the guise of it's in the best interest of this individual child and what is appropriate for their educational needs. And so we're stuck. We're stuck at the end in the field of special education, in that we have folks who very much advocate for inclusive education, really going back to that idea of to the maximum extent appropriate, have kids, all kids learn together, including kids with disabilities, and yet others who argue that schools have done such a miserable job of educating students with disabilities that perhaps trained special educators can do a better job if they just had an opportunity to work with these kids themselves. So we have a battle right now in the field of special education. Those that really advocate for inclusive education and that idea of, no, we should not allow for separate segregated settings to exist, coupled with or framed by the fact that our public schools have not had a sterling history in terms of educating students with disabilities. So why would we set some of these kids up for failure when we can offer something that might be better than what the than what is happening in general education?
Right.
So in a nutshell, we really do see this idea of the history of special education being these three eras: the era of exclusion, the era of segregation, and to some extent now the era of integration. But again, we have no easy answers because we continue to be stuck in terms of thinking about what is the right thing to do for individuals with disabilities.
Right. Well, it seems to me that if the classes were small enough, that it should be possible to have integrated classrooms. And if each individual's growth was based on the way that they learned, then you could have a totally integrated classroom. And maybe that's idealistic, but we were on our way before this crisis in education, or at least that's what I see. I mean, we aren't even doing a good job educating those quote-unquote kids who are not special need. And then a lot of the kids who get labeled special need, you know, they don't even know really. They throw drugs at problems before they throw talking at problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just hoping that those issues are being addressed as well. And so that leads me to the next question. Sarah, did you want to comment on that?
I think that Emiliano did a great job.
Speak up. You have to speak up.
I'm sorry. I think that Emiliano did a great job going over the history of special education. My family has been in special education for a very long time. My uncle Michael was born in 1952, and he was born blind. And of course, his mother had to fight to get him into the same school that my father and his other brother were also going to the point where the only way that they would allow for her to have him in the same school was if she would translate all of his books into Braille on her own. And so she took that upon herself to do so that he could go to the same school.
Hear, hear. Well, now to the next question. How has No Child Left Behind influenced special education? Has it?
Oh, in many, many ways. And surprisingly, depending on who you ask, not necessarily negative or all negative. And I know that the No Child Left Behind Act within the educational community, there tends to be a lot of bad press about the No Child Left Behind Act. And I think, indeed, there are some negative things about it. But
well, what I have heard is if they'd fund it, it would be great.
Well, that's one of the aspects is funding it. But I think, you know, as I reflect back in terms of thinking about the impact of the No Child Left Behind Act, and I don't know, again, your listeners in terms of their understanding about the history of how laws are formed, but again, the No Child Left Behind Act is simply just a reiteration of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act in the 1950s that really allowed for the formation of our public schools and really the funding of our public schools. So again, I think that we need to keep in mind that federal legislation really does mirror or reflect, in some sense, somebody's priority about what needs to happen. And some of the positive things related to the No Child Left Behind Act, I see from my perspective as an educator, it's this idea of we are going to have and need to have high expectations for all children.
Yes.
Including children with disabilities.
Yes.
Including children with disabilities. And again, we have for so long had this image or idea that individuals with disabilities are not necessarily going to be as successful. And so we place this, and I think hopefully we'll talk a little bit later on this idea about labeling, but we have our labels set certain expectations about what we think students can and cannot do. And one of the things that I appreciate is this idea of that we need to have high expectations for all kids, including kids with disabilities. The second piece is this
not
idea.
Not just holding pens.
Not just holding pens, engaging in real ways with teaching and learning. Another way is this idea of accountability, and that is a double-edged sword. right? On the one hand, I think we need to hold ourselves as educators accountable for our successes. But again, as you had stated, we need to make sure that we give the teachers the resources, the time, and the funding to be able to do it. So it can't just come with accountability without resources related to that. And that's one of the things that I think we're struggling with as a system of education. And again, another piece that I think is sort of hidden in the debate about No Child Left Behind Act is this idea of we must count how well all of our students, and that includes students with disabilities, that for many years, not a lot of people know this, but for many years, we have sort of padded our numbers as the State Department of Education in terms of reporting our successes about how we're doing educating students. We have padded it because we've removed students with disabilities from the equation. And so when we say, and again, we have to remember that education is a political process, and it's, you know, Texas versus California versus Alabama versus New Hampshire, right? Mm-hmm. And the states are always competing about how well their students are doing. Well, again, California, and arguably all other states as well, have removed students with disabilities from the equation when we're reporting our successes as a state. You know, so many kids can read at this grade level, and so many kids graduate. What we have done in strategic ways, I would argue, is remove students with disabilities from the equation in order to paint a better picture about how we're doing as a public, a state-funded education system. No Child Left Behind Act does not allow that. It says we have to hold ourselves accountable for all children, including children with disabilities. So it's putting pressure on school districts and principals and teachers to really recognize that students with disabilities belong to them. And Athena, it goes back to a little about what we were talking about earlier in terms of this idea of segregation versus inclusion. And one of the conceptual shifts that I think needs to happen in our educational system is this idea of ownership, right? Who do these kids, and by these kids I'm talking about students with disabilities, who do they belong to? That we still have the remnants of this idea of a separate, segregated educational system. And so at some point, we have the kids that we consider general education or without disabilities, and in some ways, the kids in special education. Like, we have these two separate groupings. And still and yet, to this day, we still have teachers who believe, if you ask them, that students with disabilities shouldn't be educated in their classroom. They belong someplace else. They don't take ownership for these kids, that we have a system of special education, right? So, and we have teachers trained to do it, right? So maybe this kid doesn't belong in our classroom or in my classroom. So again, the No Child Left Behind Act puts more pressure and maybe adds a little light to a dark corner that hasn't happened before to say, wait a minute, let's really take into account all the kids, including students with disabilities. No Child Left Behind Act has certainly, in addition to those positive things, brought many negative challenges. Stress on completing graduation for students with disabilities, a whole California high school exit exam issue, this idea of if we're using single measures, single ways to assess how well students are doing, we're going to give them the CAT, whatever number we're at, 6 or 9 or 12, the California Achievement Test, we're putting it in front of students who can't read and can't write, because the No Child Left Behind Act says we need to show equal and fair accountability for all kids. So yes, it makes sense that if we want to paint a true picture about how we're doing as an educational system, we have to use the same kinds of assessments if we're going to be fair about how we're reporting.
The verbal analytic.
Exactly.
Verbal analytic.
And but some kids are going to struggle with that. And again,
of course,
who are we blaming? Are we blaming the test, or are we blaming the individual with the disability who perhaps that's not the way that they learn best or show best what they know?
That's right.
So No Child Left Behind Act certainly brings with it some pretty significant challenges for those in the field of special education.
Yes, from my perspective, Emiliano, it denies all of the research about the multiple ways of that intelligence that we learn.
Yeah.
It just denies that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll get back to that, because I want to get to this question. Sarah, did you have something about No Child Left Behind?
The only thing that I wanted to talk about for a moment was to go back to the accountability. And I've always had issues with the fact that a student comes into my classroom and maybe 2, 3, 4 years below grade level in reading, and by the end of the year, I'm supposed to have them on grade level. Now, then I am judged if we call accountability and say I get a pay raise if I get this child up to grade level. Well, there's no way. I will get that child up to grade level. So if they did something where at the beginning of the year the students took a test, and at the end of the year the students took the test, and if the student showed a certain amount of growth between those two tests, then I did my job. But I don't like being judged on whether I'm doing a good job on the fact that all of my students that are coming in are already below grade level. And there's no way they're going to gain 3 or 4 years in 1 year. And how, therefore, I'm being judged on what's happened all those other years.
And does no child left behind take into effect all, are all the child's needs being met? Is the child hungry? Is the child stressed? Is the child fearful? Does the child have a place to sleep? All of those things will affect learning.
Right. And again, I think the No Child Left Behind Act is bringing that idea of the federal perspective or the national perspective in terms of what we should be doing as an educational system, when I think what we're talking about here, and Sarah expressed it beautifully, this idea of what is really happening in the classrooms.
Right.
And you know, one of the pieces of the No Child Left Behind Act, I think that as educators we need to pay particular attention, is this idea of merit pay. And to what extent are we going to reward Sarah for her ability to take a child who's at third grade and teach them 3 or 4 years worth of curriculum in one
right.
year? Is that realistic? Or are we going to penalize her for taking somebody who's in third grade? And again, she's moved them up to fourth grade in terms of their reading and writing skills. But the child remains at a sixth grade or seventh grade age level, and so technically she's not doing her job, and would she be sanctioned when indeed she has made adequate progress for that individual student?
Right.
And again, that's the catch-22 about special education and its relationship, or in some ways conflict, with the No Child Left Behind Act, because the IDEA, the law that does protect the rights for individuals with disabilities, allows for that individual decision. And in some ways, Athena, it flies in direct contrast to the No Child Left Behind Act. And
yes.
I could just go on for hours about the many conflicts.
That right. And this, it's sort of when you were talking about merit pay, this new thing that's coming up about not having tenure, but rewarding student teachers by the success that they have mm-hmm. in the classroom. And some people are very eager for that to happen, and others are, oh my goodness. And so I'm sure that debate will rage on. Well, now this question, this is a question that I'm really interested in hearing about. Not that I wasn't in the others, but this one especially. Does the label special ed have a negative psychological effect on a student?
I love this question. Absolutely love this question. And it's something that I have been thinking about and actually researching in some ways for a number of years. And again, in the field of special education, we go round and round about this idea of labeling. So, you know, on the one hand, what positive comes out of labeling? It's an easy way for folks within the field to communicate with each other. When I say to Sarah, the student is a student with a disability on the autism spectrum disorder or has autism, she very quickly understands that there's certain characteristics, certain things that we need to be attentive to. Not that it's going to sort of zero in on that particular child, but it just communicates a lot about what we know about that individual. Not that their disability comes first, but rather as a way to communicate or to express something that we do know. Certainly funding, that if we do want to take money from the federal government, and the federal government says we need to classify individuals, then and that sort of justifies some of the money that we get from the federal government. But Athena, here's the thing about this idea of labeling, and it really goes back to this idea of the stigma that disability has in our society, right? And we have to honor and recognize the fact that as a society, we are not comfortable with this idea of disability, right? That many people won't look somebody who's in a wheelchair directly in the eye, that we turn away, that we fear, in essence, what we don't know. And I guess
or
where
we
I
don't
am,
acknowledge.
Or we don't acknowledge or don't honor these kinds of differences. I guess for me, the issue of labeling, I hope that we're at a point that as a society we can transcend it. And what I want to say there is, what's wrong with having a disability, right? If we honor the fact that disability is just a function of another piece of diversity in our society, there's nothing wrong about having a disability. And if there's nothing wrong about having a disability, what's the problem with the label? And let me give you a very clear example that happened to us in our history in special education. So for many years, we called individuals who had mental retardation mentally retarded. It was in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a movement to say, oh, we can't call individuals who are mentally retarded. We should use another label. And so for a period of time there, on our forms in special education, we're loaded with forms and paperwork. We actually moved to this label called limited cognitive functioning.
Limited cognitive functioning, LCF.
And that was a little checkbox that you would mark when you wanted to indicate that somebody had mental retardation. And so it was, you know, it was the sort of the code that we used to avoid this idea of labeling. And it was great in that right after that started happening, parents were saying, what does that mean? And other educators were saying, what does that mean? And so we would say, well, you know, your child has limited cognitive functioning. And we'd whisper, mental retardation, right? And so finally, some advocacy groups said, wait a minute, we're talking about mental retardation. And they started that paradigm shift, Athena. They started saying, what's wrong with having mental retardation? There's nothing wrong with the label. That we have to, as a society, create this paradigm shift and begin to recognize there's nothing wrong with having a disability. And if there's nothing wrong with having a disability, what's the problem with the labels? Right. The labels are negative only in that we see disability as negative in our society.
We see it as pejorative.
Exactly. Yes. If we get rid of the stigma, we get rid of the negativity.
Right. Well, I want to get back to this this topic, but first of all, I want to ID the station. This you're listening to KZYX FM here in Philo, and KZYZ in Willits and Ukiah, and 88.1 in Fort Bragg. I'm Athena Melville, your host for Education Now, and we're talking here with Emiliano Ayala and Sarah Rachel Esserman about special education. And if you're just tuning in, welcome. And if not, well, we'll be opening up the lines if you want to call in and join this conversation. Our numbers here in the studio are 895-2448. Or if you're calling from far away, you can use the 800 number, 499-7117. So that's 895-2448 if you have any questions. I still have several. And I want to get back to this topic about the labeling. Pardon me. Sarah, do you have a comment before I go?
Well, I think it really depends on how it's presented to the student. And if it's presented to the student with the idea of this is the best way that you learn, and the student says, oh, so to learn, I need to do this, which of course is different than other people, and that's okay. And then you self-empower them, and they can become this advocate for themselves, so that when they go into a general education class, they can go to the teacher and say, for me to learn, I really need you to write on the board what page you're turning to or what you're saying, because I'm not auditory and I'm a visual learner. And the teacher will say, okay, and then that student will be able to join the class. And so it's not about, oh, well, I have a disability and I can't do this. And it's, this is part of who I am and this is what I need to be a student, and I want to be a student, therefore to participate.
So a good self-concept and advocating for oneself. Yes, well, I come from a tradition of a private school. You know, that's my background. And I can tell you that I had students whose parents were even teachers in the public school system, who rather than have their child labeled, would bring them to our school where I used no labels. And I didn't even read anything that anyone had written until I got made my own assessment of the student. And the difference that the parents would notice in their child's performance, just with that negative, which I'm not saying it was with the label, but something that carried with them through, because, and I think it was because if you got this label, then the district got more money for you. So they were looking to give labels. And so that was a problem. And then the other thing that I think was a problem is that for a while there in the 70s, people would use the catch-all term dyslexia for anyone who had difficulty reading. So that, you know, that was at the time when they would say, oh, well, Einstein was dyslexic, mm-hmm. right? Because he didn't read till he was 14. And And so, you know, what's the big deal about being dyslexic? And so that started turning people's heads a little bit about labels. But then you notice with President Bush, ex-President Bush, that lots of people would talk about how, well, of course, he's dyslexic. And I thought, gee, everybody out there who's dyslexic or been labeled dyslexic now has to think that they have the same kind of lack of morals and lack of interest that this man does because they're dyslexic. And so that those are some of the problems that I see that come with labels. And because I have seen by the not using them and by teaching to a child's learning, you know, abilities, that you get so much further. But of course, there's no money in that because it has to be small. When it's individualized, and you have to you're advocating for that student, and that student hopefully then learns, as Sarah did, to advocate for themselves, and all those good things happen. But since education in California dropped from number 2 in the nation before Proposition 13, and now we're down 47th or something with Arkansas and Alabama, then I have such concerns, especially about these kids who, I know for instance, many students I would get would be labeled as hyperactive and be given Ritalin, and really they were all boys. And it's just a matter that they move around. Well, you know, you have to be able to move around. So those are some of the issues that I have had, Emiliano, and that's why I asked the question. And also I had there was a particular Montessori teacher. Oh, there we have a call. Hold on now. I want to bring this caller up. Hello, you're on Education Now. Do you have a question for us?
Yes, it's to all three of you. What I'm wondering is why, after over 100 years, when we closed the schools in the summer because of agricultural reasons, that we still go along and close the schools in the summertime, and why, with all the intelligent people trying to figure out what to do with retarded children or children that are slow, are not smart enough to figure out that if we ran schools year-round, we would have a lot more money to go around because we wouldn't have to build as many schools and as many classrooms. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thank you for that call. Would either of you like to address that?
Sure, I'd love to address that. And I think it's a very valid and fair question. And I think that there have been efforts by local schools, and certainly my experience is more from Southern California that I've seen up here in Northern California, where schools were actually looking at wanting to stagger the education to actually include summer school, or just rethinking really how children learn best, and drawing from that research in terms of thinking about other alternative ways that we should be thinking about structuring our education time, as opposed to we start in September and we end in June. So there are a lot of interesting models out there where people are looking at that idea of reconfiguring the school experience, but still not challenging this idea of it has to be 180 days, which is still pretty prevalent in terms of how it is that we're approaching education. They're doing it differently by using summer in different ways. They'd have this track and that track, track A, track B, track C. So they are actually using the facilities during the summer more. And again, I see these examples more in Southern California than I do here in Northern California. But it still is not challenging that issue of why are we only educating kids for 180 days or whatever the current calendar is, right, when I think people are really beginning to recognize that research shows us that a lot of kids learn or lose learning over the summer, that we lose a lot there. This is a big political battle. And again, I said this before, make no mistake that education is a political issue.
It is a political issue. There are going to be big battles now because of the, I think, with the push for charter schools and small schools and green schools. But when I think of how much it costs to heat some of these huge schools, and when the research, at least from the people that I've, the experts that I've had on this program in childhood development, growth and development, tell you that they're alienating. Those huge schools are alienating. So why don't we have smaller schools that are more efficient to run, that are more personal, and all of that money that we're spending on these huge schools, could be put back into the kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are solutions that we're just not looking for because so many people are invested in doing things the way that we have always done them. Well, we have more calls. Shall we take them?
Absolutely.
Okay. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think it really, a lot of it has to do with budget and money. I mean, most of it has to do with money. It's not really political and as much as it's money. That the idea that the thing with the labels, you have to label it before you can pay for it. That's why labels were invented, I mean, inside the system.
Well, thank you for that comment. Do you have a question?
I have more comments. Lost my train of thought. But I think we need to get back to original what schools were about. And not so much structure, and it's got to be 180 days, and it's got to be so many, so much ADA. You hire good teachers, you put them in a room with kids, and they teach them.
Well, thank you for those comments.
The better the teachers are, the better the kids come out. And
Well, thank you for those comments. We've got some other callers, and so we're going to move on, but thank you for that call. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, wonderful show.
Thank you.
I would like to address a comment that Sarah made about being able to label how you need to have the instruction presented to you in order to fit how you learn. As a kinesthetic learner, I know that all my younger grades were taught in ways that, in my observation, primarily benefited the girls in the class, sitting quietly, and it just seemed like I looked around and all the other boys and I were bouncing off the walls, barely graduated from high school. But once I learned how to learn and to identify and be able to tell people, okay, if you present your lecture in this way, it's going to help me, I graduated summa cum laude from the university, graduate school. But that was after learning how to learn, and Sarah's point is absolutely critical. Having a system for identifying it in a language that the person that you need to have modify their behavior will understand the language that you are telling them. I'm a kinesthetic learner. Therefore, if you could do something that allows us to move around a little bit or this or that, it'll allow me to retain this information. I think that's absolutely critical and should not be discounted in any fashion. It made such a critical difference to my ability to learn. I was out of high school before I learned how to learn.
And where are you, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to ask, were you going to school in California?
I did my undergrad, all my grade school was in California.
And what years, if you don't mind?
I graduated from high school in 1975.
Uh-huh. And so that was before Prop 13. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
Yeah, but...
We were doing it. We were number two in the nation. We were doing it. And then we moved from school as an extension of the family to this business model. Thank you for your comments. Yes?
Wait, let me say one thing there, though. I was before Prop 13.
Yes.
The school system did not address it correctly at that time.
No, but they were on their way. They Myers-Briggs and Jung's work on all the different ways of learning was just coming out, and we were moving in that direction. Of course, we had segregated the kids out who were accelerated learners instead of using them in the classroom to help with the other kids and stuff.
But
we were on our way. I'm sorry to cut you short, but I need to go because we're right at the top of the hour. We're moving there. But thank you so much for this call. Do either of you want to address that caller?
Yeah, one of the exciting things, and you alluded to this when you were giving my introduction, is this idea of universal design for learning. And boy, I've taken a hold of this, and just it makes so much more sense to me in terms of we really need to be thoughtful about how we design our curriculum, how we engage students in the learning process, and how we ask for them to show what they know, right? That we need to do, and it's exciting to see that this is pieces of this are really taking off in the K-12 system and in higher education. And it really honors this idea that people have different learning styles.
Yes.
Right? And we have different ways that we need to approach the teaching and learning
yes.
process. And that a great example of that is, a person who can't see. And we, how do we commonly give curriculum? Well, we hand them a textbook, and we say, okay, well, this is the way that we're delivering the curriculum. And then we say, oh, but you can't see, so we're going to have to change it in order to make the curriculum accessible to you. The idea of universal design for learning is moving away from that idea that the person has a disability, but rather it's a print disability.
Yes.
The book has the disability, not the person. It was the choice of the curriculum that actually set up the disability
yes.
for the person, as opposed to ownership that we need to take as educators to say, wait a minute, who are my students, and am I doing everything necessary in order to ensure that I'm not creating learning barriers in the classroom?
Yes.
Universal
yes.
design for learning. Look it up. Some great stuff happening there.
Thank you so much. Any final comments from the two of you? Because we have to zoom out.
I just want to thank you, Athena, for doing this, and Emiliano for coming in.
It was a great
Speak
pleasure
up,
being here.
Sarah. Did you say thank you?
Yes, I just wanted to thank you, Athena, and to thank Emiliano. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Emiliano. Thank you for coming. Can I contact information if the people want to get a hold of you? Do you want to give contact information, or do you just want them to email me and I'll send it to you?
Email you, and that would
All
be
right.
great.
So if you want a contact with Sarah or with Emiliano, just email me at hermes@pacific.net, and I'll get that message to you. Thank you for all your calls, and I'm sorry we couldn't take all of you, but we just have to go. Thank you again, Emiliano and Sarah.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for tonight, and I thank you so much, and I hope you enjoyed it. I want to tell you that coming up on Monday, you should tune in for Els Cooper Writer's show. She's going on Monday morning at 9 o'clock. She's going to be talking about public transportation on the Reality Report at 9 a.m., so you won't want to miss that. And Friday, tomorrow, here on KZYX and Z, the Access Program at 9 in the morning. Join Norm Duvall with his guest, Paul Tichnan, of the Mendocino County Office of Education. That'll be a great show. And then Corporations and Democracy, Friday at 1 p.m. Tune in for a look at talk about the new fair elections bill on both the national and state levels with Sarah from Common Cause and Julie Raja of the California Clean Money Campaign. And, of course, there's always great music here on KZYX and Z. Tonight, right after Earth and Sky, you're going to hear from that man of wonderful comedy, W. Dan, and the Treehouse, and then it'll be Dead Air. So here we go with Earth and Sky. Thank you all for listening. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, K201HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and we also stream on the web at kzyx.org. Thank you to the staff here at KZYX and Z. Thank you to the producers of Education Now, and thank you one and all for listening. Here we go now with Earth and Sky.